Great to have you with us here today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, and today we're going to be exploring wind energy with a couple of guests, John Greenler and James Tingem. John directs education and outreach at the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center. John, great to have you back.
Pleasure to be here, Larry. As always, thank you.
And James is an associate professor of engineering professional development, has a lot of experience with wind energy. And Jim, it's good to have you here as well.
Pleasure being here. It's a great day for wind.
Yeah, it's always a good day for wind. And I'm kind of windy myself once in a while. And maybe we'll get some calls about wind. I bet you we do. Do you live near a wind farm? Maybe you have some questions about wind energy. What alternative energy sources do you think Wisconsin should be investing in? So those are some of the things we can talk about. You can join us at 800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page. Jim, you biked across Wisconsin, Iowa, and Minnesota. Took a heck of a trip. And you passed, and you were really out there to look at wind energy sites.
Yes, this July and August, I took a 19-day pedal bike trip, 1,273 miles, and I visited, biked by 48 wind energy plants across Wisconsin, Minnesota, and Iowa, and just got a lot of perspective of how they fit into the landscape and the culture and how the communities accept them and just what the view sheds look like.
Yeah, we'll talk some more about that. But just thinking overall, the numbers on wind energy and what it has done so far and what it can do.
Well, in Wisconsin, we get about 2.4 to about 2.5% of our in-state consumption from wind energy. That's a lot different than our neighboring states. Iowa is in the mid-30s. Minnesota is getting close to 20% of their electrical consumption is from wind energy. And even Illinois is approaching 6%. So we are, although
kind of lagging
okay,
there.
We're lacking. We're following in the footsteps of our neighbors.
Yeah. John, that's pretty incredible.
Yeah, I mean, I think the opportunity is significant, and importantly, it's also really necessary. If anything, as we look towards the future and moving away from fossil fuels, we're going to need more electricity, and this is the opportunity to bring in renewables for sure.
Yeah, and where? Where are most of our developments in the state right now?
Well, most of our developments are along the Niagara Escarpment in the Fox River Valley. So think Calumet County and down. But we also have some closer towards Platteville in Montford. Mm-hmm. And there's a proposed site up in Lafayette County is building one right now, Cashton. But mostly that Green Bay down Fox River Valley corridor is where most of the best wind resource is.
Yeah, and I suppose that's why I was thinking about Iowa. Well, they get 30-some percent of their energy from wind, but they're, I don't know, they're flatter than we are, aren't they? Or what is it about Iowa that makes them so...
Well, Iowa has a slightly better wind resource because they don't have the topography that blocks the wind, so they have better sustained, slightly higher velocity wind. But the other thing about Iowa that allows for greater development is they have larger properties. Right. So you have farmers with 1,000, 2,000 acres, versus Wisconsin, you have more properties, 100 acres here, 400 acres here. It's harder to site and develop a wind energy site in Wisconsin because you have to deal with so many neighbors, adjoining properties, mm-hmm. and similar versus Iowa. You're dealing with fewer farms, fewer owners.
What is the advantage to farmers? Is there a financial incentive for this? Or what kinds of things, how are they helped?
Yeah, the farmers often call this their drought insurance because depends where you are. But I talked to one farmer in Iowa on my bike trip. He was getting $8,000 per year per turbine, and he had five turbines on his farm. So he was $40,000. He said that's a F-250 pickup every year, is how he explained it to me. And it varies upwards of $12,000 per turbine down to maybe $3,000, $4,000 in other areas where there's lots of competitions or areas where you can put turbines in.
Yeah.
Not insignificant.
No, and this, you know, that number of turbines can be quite a bit larger than even, you know, for some of the big farms. I know, like in Utah, it's not uncommon for a landowner to have even a couple dozen units on their property. So,
wow. So we're talking about a fair amount of money. And there are, I mean, there's infrastructure and things of that nature that could hinder or maybe even help farmers.
When we put in these scale of wind turbines, we need to build access roads. And those access roads are also very good for the farmers for harvesting, planting, and similar, because they're built as all-weather, all-access roads. It's another incidental benefit to farmers.
Yeah. Well, Martin in Friendship has a question for you, so let's go there. Hi, Martin. Thanks for calling.
Good morning. My question is about bird kill in wind turbines.
Sure.
And my suggestion for alternative energy is hydro. The DNR is currently very, very opposed to micro hydro, which in the aggregate can add considerably.
Yeah, well, let's thank you for calling, Martin. Let's talk about that a little bit. Mm-hmm. I don't know how much, John, we can talk about hydro, but comments on that?
We can talk about hydro, and he's right. As we look at kind of distributed opportunities, hydro does provide potential, in various areas. It's also tricky because there are environmental concerns with these dams. We end up with a lot of situations where the water is really slowed down. You get a lot of kind of thermal concerns, a lot of heating of the water, which is significant for a lot of the biology associated with the rivers and streams. So that needs to be looked at pretty carefully as well.
And Jim, has there been some research? There are bird kills. You're not going to deny that. But what are the overall?
Yeah, there has been research by actually our colleagues here at the University of Wisconsin, Ken Drake and his staff. They've studied the Forward Wind Farm near Brownsville. And in that particular study, I believe they found about each turbine about one half of a bird kill per year, which is a fairly low number. It's not insignificant, but we need to think about the raw numbers, and the biggest killer of birds in Wisconsin by far is feral cats.
Mm-hmm.
And it's orders of magnitudes higher than wind turbines, windshields, the plate glass window at your house. All of these need to be considered holistically when considering bird strikes.
Yeah.
Early on, I think there were some pretty spectacular situations where turbines were sited in a poor location, where there was a fair amount of bird migration, and there were, you could go underneath a few of these turbines and find large numbers of killed birds. But I think, there's really the sighting technology and ability to kind of forecast, so to speak, where and where not to build a turbine really takes these into account. So, I think it is getting easier to predict, where there would be a problem and just staying away from those kinds of sites. And there's a lot of collaboration, for example, a lot of really good, conservation organizations, Nature Conservancy, for example, in terms of just making sure that the siting work is done properly to avoid those areas where it would be a big concern.
Yeah. What kind of research, Jim, have you been involved in as it relates? You've done a lot of work on wind turbines.
Yes, in particular, I work on balance of plant design and construction, particularly how to design the largest foundations for these taller and more powerful turbines. So I'm a civil engineer, and I work at how to minimize that foundation. And I also work on the collection trenches, how to get the power from one turbine to the next to the substation and how they dissipate heat. So I teach and do research on how to do best practices for the design and construction of wind energy sites.
Yeah. Martin, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Let's go to Scott in New Berlin next. Scott, hi. Thank you for calling. Scott, are you there? Ah, I think we lost Scott, but he had some questions about the energy density of it as of wind turbines as compared to, say, nuclear or perhaps coal. John, you want to comment on that?
Sure. I mean, you know, it's you know, when you're looking at a wind energy type system, and Jim can, you know, go on this as well, you know, it definitely takes, you know, a fairly big area. I mean, frequently that area can be utilized for, you know, multiple purposes. Clearly farming, you know, in the Midwest is a really good example of that, where it's, you know, there's a fair amount of compatibility. But then, you know, we compare with nuclear or with using fossil fuels, especially coal, yes, they're more energy dense, but, you know, there's so many different dimensions to considering and comparing these different, you know, energy resources. So, for example, with nuclear right now, you know, we are in a situation where, you know, where nuclear is really economically challenged, both because of the fact that natural gas has become much less expensive, and a lot of these renewables are really becoming competitive as well. So, you know, there's an economic factor there. We look at something like coal. Now, coal is, you know, is inexpensive, but there's a whole host of other concerns. You know, we can look at health concerns in terms of particulate pollution. Clearly, there's significant concerns also in terms of CO2 emissions, you know, greenhouse gas that, you know, we know is responsible for global warming and climate change. So we need to look at all of those together. So,
yeah, I'm sorry we lost you, and I we'll move on to Carl in Antioch, Illinois, then. Hi, Carl.
Hi, it's actually Carrie.
Oh, sorry, Carrie.
That's okay. I happens all the time. So I've been researching putting wind energy onto my home or, you know, onto my property. I just live in a normal subdivision, but I found that the vertical wind turbines, I know they're not actually called that, but I always forget the name, that they don't, you know, kill the bird population. And I'm really curious why they don't use that on the larger scale, because I don't know. Just, can you help me out with that?
Thanks, Carrie.
Sure. You're referring to a vertical axis turbine where it rotates around that vertical axis versus a horizontal axis. The reason that we don't use them on large scale is because they're less efficient at that scale and significantly less efficient. So when you want to get the most energy out of the wind at hub heights as high as a football field, the horizontal axis, the ones that you're familiar seeing in Illinois and Wisconsin, are much, much more efficient.
Yeah, it is interesting. Like our we actually here at the university, we have a Department of Energy funded wind competition team each year. And last year, they had an interesting challenge where they were designing turbines to function in remote locations on cell towers in India. And actually, they did in that situation choose a vertical, horizontal axis, sorry, turbine design, in part because they're actually much simpler and they don't require the, you know, as much maintenance and upkeep. So in that situation, it did seem like it, you know, it had had an advantage. So
what about Carrie for her home?
Even though I love wind energy, I usually do not advise homeowners to put wind energy in, because it's probably at residential scale, it's probably going to be your most expensive option. I generally push people towards geothermal exchange or solar for residences. The bigger your scale, then the wind energy economic advantages come through, but not necessarily at the residential scale.
That's true even at the commercial level. I mean, the past couple of years, the turbines have gotten a lot bigger, and that's what's really, in part, made them more price competitive, if I'm correct?
Yeah, so we're, you know, a modern turbine going up today is about 2 megawatts, and that is enough, one turbine, to supply about 500 to 600 households. So that's the scale. One turbine, 500 to 600 households of electricity.
It's impressive.
There you go, Carrie.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page. Talking today with James Tingem, Associate Professor of Engineering Professional Development, and John Greenler, who directs education programs at the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center and the Wisconsin Energy Institute. I'm Larry Mueller. Cheryl Gasser, our on-air producer, here on the Ideas Network. Coming up at 11:45, it's time for our monthly check-in with the weather guys. So we'll talk about the recent cold spell and answer all of your weather questions at 11:45. Right now, taking a look at the benefits and challenges of wind energy with Jim Tingem of the Department of UW Engineering and Professional Development and John Greenler, directs education programs at the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center and the Wisconsin Energy Institute. Anna Lisa in Green Bay, it's your turn now. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, I'm grateful for this program. We have had, my question is about the health effects of wind farms. We have had considerable resistance up here in this area, people claiming that the windmills are making them sick, and to the point that I don't think efforts are going forward the way they might if there weren't for all this resistance. So if you help me with that, I'd appreciate it.
Yeah. Can I comment on that?
Well, I'm not a medical doctor, but the studies that I have read have not found any causal relationships between ultra-low frequency or any emissions from a wind turbine with demonstrated health effects, including nausea, difficulty in sleeping, headaches, and the similar. So in large-scale studies in Massachusetts, Canada, Australia, study after study after study is not finding any direct links. However, I will say that there is an illness called wind turbine syndrome that people, if they think they're going to get sick because they're next to one, they will actually psychologically make themselves sick, and they'll feel real issues with sleeping or anxiety or similar. So that's wind turbine syndrome, and it's a more of a psychological factor, but it's not real. It's not related to anything coming from noise or vibrations from those wind turbines.
Now, you biked around the state, and so you were, you know, you weren't in your car. You were listening, and you were pretty close to these turbines. And of course, you have experience. You've been researching turbines for a long time. What's your estimate in terms of noise and so forth?
Yeah, so I bike by probably thousands of wind turbines, some very close, you know, within 100 feet or so. Generally speaking, I had to get off my bike and quiet myself down to be able to hear the turbine. Modern turbines are very quiet. You'll get close, you will hear that swooshing, or whoosh, 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 from every time the blade comes by. But really, at the setbacks in Wisconsin, you generally shouldn't be able to hear the turbine under most normal conditions.
You know, it's also interesting to juxtapose those health concerns with the more, you know, distant but significant health impacts that we have, you know, with our current energy system in terms of the fossil fuels that we use. It's easy. They're kind of out of sight and out of mind. But, you know, when you crunch the numbers, it's a huge impact on our economy. We pay for, you know, the gas that we use for our cars and the coal for our power plants, you know, quite significantly. You know, and actually there's a professor here, Jonathan Patz, who's done a lot of research. And it really shows when you crunch the numbers and you think about converting to these clean energy systems, you know, they more than pay for themselves in terms of decreased costs, in terms of, you know, kind of larger scale health concerns.
Interesting. Kendra in Milwaukee, we turn to you next. Hi, Kendra.
Hi there. I heard your speaker mention that wind is not really efficient on a small scale for a household, but geothermal is. And I live in the city of Milwaukee, and there are, you know, pipes and wires and all kinds of stuff running around on the property. And I didn't know if you can actually use geothermal in that sort of circumstance.
Mm-hmm. Well, yes, you can if you have a little bit of a backyard to be able to drill anywhere from 2 or 3 borings. You can put geothermal exchange in. And if it's properly designed and implemented, you're going to reduce about 60% of your household energy bill, because about 60% of your typical household bill goes towards heating, cooling, and domestic hot water heating. all of those geothermal exchange is going to cut your energy bill for that large section of your household energy expenses.
And there are two different kinds of geothermal designs, right? There's kind of the more vertical versus the horizontal, and many people don't realize it doesn't take that big a footprint if you're going with the vertical type setup, if that's the right terminology.
Yeah, it is. You need one 250-foot deep hole for about every 1 ton of heating capacity in your home. A typical home has somewhere between 2 to 4 tons of heating and cooling demand, so you typically need somewhere between 2 to 4 borings to make geothermal exchange work.
Kendra, I live in the city of Madison, and I put 4 180-foot holes drilled in my driveway for a geothermal, so it can be done in residential areas for sure.
And do we have skilled technicians in the area?
Well, that's the thing. You want to make sure you've got a skilled person, right, Jim?
Yes. Do your homework. There are reputable geothermal exchange providers that will do this, but you probably don't want to use the guy or gal down the road that just does it part-time.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, thanks for calling. Eric in DeSoto, your turn. Hi, Eric.
Yeah.
What's on your mind today?
Oh, I was wanted to ask if there's been any studies on the benefits of doing the wind offshore on Lake Michigan. I know the wind resource out there is much, much better. I did an analysis, and I got a pretty good setup on racing to Burns Harbor, Indiana. That's, perpendicular to prevailing winds, and the water's fairly shallow there. Now, I know it's a lot deeper in northern Lake Michigan, but, have you heard anything about people talking about, the benefits of putting, turbines in terms of consistent power out on the lakes?
Yeah.
Yes, there's actually been some studies, including in my department, my research department, civil engineering. We've looked at the potential for large-scale wind in Lake Michigan, and the potential is there. We could get a lot of wind energy, upwards of 20-30% of the consumption in Wisconsin. However, to construct it out in Lake Michigan, it's about 2 to 2.5 times more expensive per megawatt than on land. So to be honest, right now in Wisconsin, it's much cheaper to build these on land and or to import energy from Iowa or Minnesota, where the economics of their situation is much more favorable than building out in the lake right now.
Yeah.
It is an area where I think there's a lot of advancements which are being made. I mean, I think, we're seeing more and more offshore, in part because, the engineering work is coming forward to figure out how to do that in increasingly more economical fashion.
Well, you'd think, we've got all this experience with offshore oil well, drilling and the kinds of setups that they need. Now, of course, that's not exactly the same, but I would think there's been a fair amount of work in that area, Jim.
Yeah, with those offshore platforms and foundations, you really need an industry that's available to do that, that has the knowledge and experience to do that. Right now, that industry, the harbors with the capacity to do that, it's just not located in the Great Lakes like it is down in the Gulf of Mexico and similar. That expertise and that equipment is just not up here.
Right. Yeah, but I think there's an increasing use of offshore, in Europe and Scandinavia, for example. So I think, there are models coming on that we can look towards for the future.
Okay. Thanks, Eric. Appreciate it. Carol in Gutenberg, Iowa, your turn. Hi, Carol.
Oh, good morning, Larry, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Okay, what is the optimum number of acres? Let's say I am in Iowa, and you were talking before about the topography here. Per wind turbine, how many acres can be put on a turbine, assuming it's pretty level?
Yeah, gotcha.
Yeah. So the rule of thumb, because you can't put the turbines right next to each other because they block the wind from one to the next and they interfere with each other, the most optimum design is about one turbine per 25 acres. Rule of thumb, if you got 100 acres, you could probably put 4 or 5 turbines out there.
Okay. Do they need to be a certain distance from a homestead?
Yes. Each state is going to have setback requirements. So, as an example, here in Wisconsin, the wind turbine has to be set back at least 1,250 feet from an occupied residence.
Okay.
And Iowa probably has similar types of requirements on setbacks.
Okay, so 1,200 feet. Also, are wind turbines, the ground that they're on, are they compatible with plantings, specifically like honeybees, wildflower plantings for honeybees?
Yeah. Well, first off, when you put a wind turbine in, you're going to take a little bit of acreage out of production to support that structure. That's typically about a quarter of an acre to maybe a half of an acre. Now, they'll reclaim part of that where the crane pad used to be. They'll come back and dig that up and try to recultivate it and regrow. But usually all you're left with is a small gravel pad and an access road going to the turbine, and everything else is converted back to agricultural production.
Yeah. And it's interesting, we go further west, turbine sightings and natural areas, you have to be have some additional considerations in terms of location. A really interesting story in terms of birds is the conservation of the sage grouse, the plains out there, the sage grouse sees a wind turbine, thinks it's a big tree where there might be a raptor roosting that would come down and take its young. And so there you need to kind of consider, not just, how the plants work, but also, what's happening with the birds in terms of they're kind of responding to changes in their landscape. So, but here in the Midwest, we're mainly putting into, agricultural acreage, there aren't as many of those kinds of concerns.
Yeah, interesting.
Sure. Could I ask just one last question?
Sure.
As far as industry jobs, not my own children, right, but I have a young person who's been working in the beekeeping industry with me and loves the outdoors. I'll get off the phone, but talk about getting into the industry for a young person.
Yeah.
Well, within wind energy, every 10 turbines out there probably has one full-time service maintenance technician there. So number one, if you have 100 turbines on the site, there's probably 10 to 20 people working on that site. That's a very physical job. You're climbing ladders and you're going up 80, 100 meters. But it's great mechanical, electrical work. Other jobs in Wisconsin is the supply chain. I'll stick with Manitowoc as an example. Manitowoc cranes are manufactured there, and those cranes are used for wind turbine construction across North America. There's also Broadwind Towers is located in Manitowoc, and they employ, I believe, about 270 people manufacturing the towers. So there's a manufacturing footprint here in Wisconsin that definitely assists with the wind energy business.
When we look forward, and project in terms of what's going to be limiting in terms of our being able to deploy wind energy, for example, one of the big ones that comes up is having the person power, having the skilled and trained labor to be able to do the work. And so, it's a really important question.
Do we have training for that? I mean,
it's interesting. Even here in Madison at MATC, we actually have some really good programs that actually train the teachers for tech colleges and whatever. And they're actually training educators here in Wisconsin that work all over the country. So, we have a number of technical colleges which actually have really good programming for students as well.
Tim and Marinette, your turn. Hi, Tim.
I was wondering if your guest is familiar with the three-bladed vertical turbine that has the blades that are based on the Apache helicopter.
I personally am not aware of the analogy to the Apache.
Yeah.
Are you familiar with three-bladed?
Well, three-bladed is the standard horizontal access design. That's the most efficient recovery of kinetic energy from the wind is the three-blade system.
So, that's what you see when you're driving around.
No, I'm not talking about those. I'm talking about these are round. They spin around.
Oh.
And what you do is you pour a concrete pad, you mount the base, and then there's a hinge, and then you raise the turbine up, and it spins around.
Yeah.
Yeah, so going back to a previous caller, I would guess that fits into the vertical access turbine. And those designs are out there, but I haven't seen them available at utility scale where they make sense yet.
Oh, so still some work going on in that area.
Yeah, for a remote location where durability, I think, is, you know, is really important, they definitely have a place.
Thanks, Tim. Appreciate it. Ann and Monona, your turn. Hi, Ann. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Well, I had a question about who is involved in final decisions about whether and when, you know, and where these wind turbines will be installed. I've seen one in, you know, I've seen wind turbines in Montford, but it was quite a while ago. But my concern is that I wonder whether the people who do these studies that show that low-frequency noise of this kind that doesn't stop, or, you know, that stops only according to the wind's, you know, whatever the wind is doing, can be extremely disruptive of sleep and of normal life. They're so close to these small communities often when you see them, and there are so many of them. And I was wondering why there can't be smaller, you know, wind farms. Why does everything have to be on such a big scale that people are going to be disturbed if they live in that area?
So in Wisconsin, you are correct. The Public Service Commission of Wisconsin is responsible for the approval process. So a developer, a utility, whoever is proposing a site will have to propose through the Public Service Commission, and it goes through a process, whether the utility needs that energy, if it's cost-effective, if there's environmental concerns, and similar. Regarding the ultra low frequency noise, 20 hertz or less. Couple of things. That is a very common frequency in nature. You'll get similar frequencies coming from a truck driving down a road, your car, your heartbeat, your breathing rate. So our bodies are used to that frequency as is. So do wind turbines produce some low frequency noise? They do, but it's a natural frequency. And again, here in Wisconsin, there has been some studies, and they have not linked it objectively to objectively verified human health concerns here in Wisconsin.
And what's the apparently there are a lot of wind turbines in Iowa, for example, because they're providing 30 some percent of their total energy needs. What kind of, I think, acceptance there must be pretty high among the people who live there.
It is, and it's one of the reasons why I went on my 1,300-mile bike trip. I really wanted to get perspectives in the cafes, gas stations, meeting areas, whoever would come up and talk to me. I found, generally speaking, in Wisconsin that people were less educated. They didn't have as much information about wind turbines. There was concerns such as this. However, once you get to Iowa, it was readily accepted. It's as natural as anything. It's like, oh, Farmer Joe is going to be working on a new wind farm in his property, and good for him. You know, he's going to get a new F-250 every year. So Iowa, I found very accepting of wind energy. I didn't come across anybody in Iowa that really had any concerns or major discussion negatively on wind energy, because they accept it, wind energy. They know what it does to their economy, and they see the economy, not just for the farmers, but all for all the manufacturing base that is in Iowa to support that industry.
Yeah, there we go. Thanks, Ann, for calling. Steve in Madison, your turn. Hi, Steve.
Hello. My question is, I remember a study back in the 1970s, I think, by Carol DeWinkle, who did it for, I think it was Alliant Energy or somebody like that, that found a strong correlation between wind energy patterns in Wisconsin and peak load electric demand. And I'm just wondering if wind generators are being sited today with that in mind to specifically address peak demand, so that rather than replace power plants to reduce the need for additional or larger plants.
Hmm. Well, there's going to be positives and negatives about wind energy with respect to peak loads. In the winter, when all of our heating systems go on, our fans go on through the middle of the night, and we have peak loads in the winter, that's generally speaking right when wind energy is contributing the maximum amount of energy into the grid. So it matches very well in winter. However, in the summer, particularly in August, the energy produced by wind turbines doesn't meet that peak demand. So there's got to be other resources out there that assist with that peak demand. Primary reason is there's less wind in the summer and the air density is less. So there's just less energy available. And so it's not a great peak load match in end of July, August, early September.
Yeah,
it is interesting to look, though, at the full suite of technologies which are coming on in terms of being able to manage, you know, the more dynamic, clean energy, whether it's, you know, complementarity with solar, but also, you know, storage technologies are really advancing quite rapidly, actually far more quickly than I think any of us really anticipated. And we now have, you know, commercial scale battery, you know, facilities, you know, going online in California. The other one, which isn't as obvious, which I think is really interesting, you know, demand-side technology. How do we work on the other side of the formula in terms of saying how can we develop more plasticity in terms of when we need to use electricity and how can we level off those peak loads to complement these renewable energy systems?
Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And so just as we're kind of wrapping up here, what do you think is the potential here in Wisconsin? I mean, we're at a couple of percent of our energy coming from wind. What's your estimate on what'll happen, Jim?
Yeah. Well, first I'll give you the optimistic assessment. I think with current technology is we could probably get 10% of our electrical energy use in Wisconsin from wind energy and normal process and the like. I don't think that we're going to get there without two things. Is number one, is there has to be some form of policy initiative from state or utilities or similar. And the second thing is our electrical demand is not growing very fast in Wisconsin. So if our electrical needs don't grow, there's no need to put any plants of any type out there. So those are the two hurdles that we're probably going against. Is we really don't need additional electrical capacity right now with growth rates. And secondly, there's no strong policy push in Wisconsin to ask for more wind energy.
Yeah, interesting. Well, guys, it's been fun talking with you today. Thank you so much for being with us. Look forward to another visit. Thank you.
Thanks, Larry.
Thanks much, Larry.
Jim Tingem is an associate professor of engineering professional development. John Greenler directs education programs at the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center, GLBRC, we call it, and the Wisconsin Energy Institute. Great to have them along, and we'll talk some more about wind energy as we move along. Always an interesting topic to me, and I hope it is to you as well. I like to talk about the weather, too. How about you? Our weather guy's up next to talk about what's going on climate and weather-wise. Stay with us.